Hello, I'm Kevin Keith. In this episode of Skeptical Ethics, we'll take a look at a controversy that continues to roil skepticism, applying the tools of skepticism to our own community. I'm referring to the recent controversies over sexist attitudes or behavior at skeptical conventions, and attitudes of insensitivity to or even endorsement of misogyny within the skeptical community. Anyone who's active in or pays attention to organized skepticism will recognize what I'm referring to, and is probably familiar with events and controversies over the past year or two that have brought this issue to prominence within the community. Rather than rehashing those arguments, I'd like to take a look at how, as skeptics, we can view and understand them. I think the one fundamental test of our commitment to skepticism is the willingness to apply the tools and critical perspective of skepticism to skepticism itself, and to the skeptical community as a part of society. The ongoing debate over harassment and misogyny provides an unfortunately necessary opportunity to do so. Before we start, let me remind listeners that the Skeptical Ethics series attempts to apply skeptical reasoning to value-based issues such as moral or cultural controversies. New listeners, or those who want to review the basic conceptual grounding of that enterprise, may wish to download the first Skeptical Ethics segment, Does Skepticism Lead to Agreement?, which appeared in Episode 2 of the Skeptical Connections podcast, and the second segment, Moral Agreement Among Skeptics, from Episode 3 of Skeptical Connections, for useful background. As I said, most people interested in skepticism will have seen a lot of recent discussion of sexism within the skeptical community. Without meaning to offer judgment or assess blame, let me mention a few of the most talked about incidents that defined the arc of this controversy. Most infamously, there was the case in which respected skeptical blogger Rebecca Watson gave a presentation at an atheism conference, noting the discomfort women face at conferences and other events from unwanted sexual advances. Later, after socializing with some other attendees late at night, she announced she was tired and was going to bed, whereupon one of the attendees, whom she did not know personally, followed her into an elevator and made a clumsy pass at her while she was trapped in the elevator with him, alone at 4 a.m. Watson later V-blogged this incident to the effect that it was a prime example of the kind of thoughtless and unwelcome behavior she had been talking about at that very conference. This caused some comment, notably from the very prominent skeptic Richard Dawkins, who mocked her for being offended by this behavior. A heated discussion arose in skeptical blogs and other venues, which included considerable amounts of harsh criticism and even threats against Watson and her supporters. During this timeline, the issue was raised of the atmosphere at skeptical conferences and the feelings of insecurity many women had in attending events in which women were underrepresented, sexist commentary or harassment was seen to be prevalent, and conference organizers did not appear to recognize that the issue was significant or even existed. Two notable consequences resulted. First, Watson announced she would no longer be attending the major skeptical conference, The Amazing Meeting, or TAM, because she felt the TAM organizers were downplaying the issue, after which a division developed between those who did and those who did not feel the same way. Second, a movement arose to develop rules and procedures for conferences to deal with sexism and harassment, which have now been adopted for many conferences in the skeptical and technology communities. The disagreements engendered by these efforts, however, have continued. It's easy to be tempted to take sides in these kinds of disputes, and the most immediate response when faced with stories, accusations, and disagreements of this kind is often to try to pass judgment or decide who's right and who's wrong. Dawkins's mocking response to Watson was predicated on the idea that what she experienced was insignificant compared with more oppressive discrimination faced by women in less egalitarian nations. Watson's critics also often tended to dismiss the issue as unimportant, or to regard complaints by women against male behavior as being in themselves a form of oppression. Those who upheld the issue of harassment and misogynist hostility as significant tended to emphasize the impact on women of being immersed in a pervasively sexualized, judgmental, and offensive environment, and the barrier that poses to full and equal participation in the skeptical community or the professional world. They often drew links between harassment of women in attendance at conventions and the lack of representation of women among the presenters at such conventions and among the membership of skeptical or professional organizations. Thus, there were basic disagreements not only over how important the issue was, but what its consequences were. That is, disagreement over both values and facts. That would make the issue ripe for the kind of skeptical analysis that we've emphasized in previous segments of Skeptical Ethics. We could dissect the history of these events, try to identify the reliable facts, and then relate them to the moral principles that apply. But I'd like to suggest a less formal but more fundamental way of analyzing and understanding this situation from a critical perspective. One of the things that struck me watching these incidents and arguments develop was how depressingly familiar they seemed. In fact, they sounded to me very much like arguments I heard and participated in, not always on the right side, I'm ashamed to say, when I was very young and feminists were struggling to gain respect for issues and perspectives that seem basic to us now. I'm afraid I'm dating myself here, but I grew up with feminism back when it was called women's lib, before anybody thought to call it second wave feminism. At that time, even the ideas that women should have jobs and control their own finances, or were not biologically incapable of grasping the full range of opportunities and professions made available without question to men, were regarded as shockingly controversial, and the response to them was often not a reasoned debate, but open mockery, and the use of the kind of trumped-up anecdotal examples and strained analogies that skeptics should immediately recognize with suspicion. Watching those debates of late 20th century feminism, I began to be aware of how much bad faith they represented, of how dishonest and diversionary many of the anti-feminist arguments were. I vividly recall hearing someone argue, apparently seriously, that women could not be professional chefs because all the great chefs were men. This wasn't an isolated idiot. That was, in fact, a standard argument against entry of women into that career in the 1960s and 70s. I hope it doesn't have to be pointed out how laughable that argument is, but it was typical of the kind of so-called reasoning that took place around the issues of the day. As skeptics, we pride ourselves on clear-sightedness and analytical insight. In the 1970s, what we used to call male chauvinist pigs used denial, obstruction, and mockery to prevent rational debate on the issues. Denial and mockery served the purpose of making an issue seem non-existent and of diverting the debate onto the topic of whether the issue is real rather than how to understand and resolve it. Seeing the current debate over sexism in the skeptic movement seems like a replay of the same debates and the same tactics once used against the idea of women's equality in general. Whether skepticism exists in the movement is a factual question. That question should be amenable to skeptical analysis, but the response has been something else entirely. The fact that the claim regarding sexism has been met with the tactics of obstruction is proof that skepticism has failed to be skeptical of itself. It is also an implication that, just like generations of feminists before them, women in the skeptical community who complain of mistreatment have a real issue to be discussed, or else why would it be necessary to obstruct that discussion? I haven't offered an opinion here as to who's right or wrong in the various incidents and debates that have fractured the skeptical community. My comments are directed at the way that debate and discussion have taken place. Being the victim of death threats, rape threats, and viciously sexual and personal verbal abuse, all pervasive throughout every online venue in which these issues have been raised, doesn't prove that the feminist critics of the skeptical community are right in their complaints about what happened at this or that conference. But it's a cruelly ironic, self-fulfilling proof of their claim about a misogynist environment in general. It's also evidence of a failure to critically engage the issues, a failure that is not an oversight, but a form of denial and dismissal that speaks to the same kind of desperate defensiveness that feminism faced back in the 70s. In a way, the implications of that defensiveness are true. Taking an issue seriously is an admission that there is in fact an issue to be discussed. But, and here we move from facts to values, sexism, misogyny, discomfort, and harassment are inherently issues worthy of discussion. The suggestion that there are problems of that kind is a call for respectful analysis, even if, as has not been demonstrated in the current debate, the problem turns out to be overblown. Sensitivity to the issue itself is the moral test which many in the skeptical community failed recently. The feminists of the 1970s won their greatest victory not when anybody admitted they were sexist, but when everybody agreed that sexism itself was shameful. At that point, it became impossible to defend workplace restrictions or legal barriers in a rational way. Similarly, the challenge to today's skeptical community is to move beyond denial of the issue to a moral stance from which the factual analysis then becomes easy. Skeptics must be skeptical of themselves, first and foremost. If they aren't honest enough to analyze their own behavior, who's going to listen to them on anything else? Misogyny is morally bad in its own right. It's also a sign of bad skepticism. I'd be happy to hear any of your questions, comments, or responses through skepticalconnections.com.